How loyal are your customers? What will they do? What obstacles will they get around to get to your product? Until you build a cult-like following, it's actually not a following, it's a fad. Lee Bird, chairman and CEO of the home decor giant At Home, is building a cult-like following among his loyal customers in ways that any brand, nonprofit or for-profit, could learn from. So let's hear from the brand man himself, Lee Bird. And I am at home speaking to Lee Bird, who is also at home. Is that right, Lee?
That's right. And I work at home, which it's a little confusing for people.
Well, you know, that's a sign of the times. But I just want you to know, Lee, this is not my own bedroom, but this is a guest bedroom in my house.
Okay.
And I thought, isn't there a better way that I can conduct the interview? And I thought, no, let's just do it right there in one of our guest rooms. So I hope you approve of the decor behind me.
It looks great.
All right. Well, I'm talking to an expert. So as I said in our introduction, Lee Bird is the chairman and CEO of At Home, based in Plano, Texas. And let's just start out right away, Lee, with some phenomenal news about At Home. In the second quarter of this year, which we all know that was the height of the pandemic, your company had an unbelievable performance, a 770% rise in your stock. It was a record-setting quarter for the company, which to me is the opposite of what anyone would expect when everyone is staying home and they're not shopping. They're not going out to retail stores. So what happened?
Well, we did two things. We played defense and offense at the same time. As Q1 settled in and COVID went across our country, we knew we were going to have to close our stores. So we had to prepare ourselves for store closures, but also pivot and go on the offense and accelerate our plans on e-commerce so that people felt more comfortable shopping from home, buying curbside pickup, having product delivered. Both of those services specifically weren't really available to our customers before this. So we did both. And when stores reopened, they opened just with a flurry. It was extraordinary. We had the best company performance ever for us financially. When you have 50% revenue growth, 42% same store sales growth, and that's in a quarter where some of the stores were still closed. So on a store by store basis, a 62% increase in same store sales and a over $200 million improvement in liquidity during that time. And reducing our leverage ratios now down, you know, four turns from over five times to now 1.5 times debt to EBITDA, that we really got ourselves in a beautiful position. And thankfully, because our customers wanted to come to our store and felt like we had a great value.
Well, I want to ask you about that because as you're describing that, I'm wondering how much of it is due to the strategic shifts and pivots that you made in real time. And how much of it is due to just the pent-up attitude or appetite, I should say, of the consumer to get out of their home to get into an at-home store?
Well, certainly we're blessed to be in a great category. People are all at home. We're all working from home. This is my home office. You're in a guest bedroom, so we normally would be in our own offices at this point, and we're not. So people are spending more time at home. But the category isn't growing like we were growing. And so we obviously have nice tailwinds for us, but we did a lot of things last year. We had a tough year last year, honestly. It was a time where we had some step back in same store sales performance, first time in 6 years. And we took a hard look at ourselves. And so what do we need to do to fix our performance and what's on us to go fix? And we did those things last fall and early this spring. So when we reopened, we already had our pricing sharper than ever. We had a go-to-market approach called EDLP Plus, which is campaign management to highlight our low prices. And that was reinforced with people being at home and could see our campaigns and our emails. We had enhanced our loyalty program, for example. We improved our product assortment and did what we needed to make sure we had a great assortment. So when people are ready to engage in the category, that we were the person that they would engage with. And so we had 100% increase in our online views to our website, 50% increase in our email open rates. And so that allowed us to really be more relevant than ever. And so I really do feel like we did our part to enable our customer, who is now engaging in the category more than ever, to consider our store than any other place.
Hmm. one could say, just in the nick of time, you've made these fantastic improvements. Now, you've been in your position as a CEO of the company, chairman of the board, for nearly 8 years. And you mentioned the improvements that were made in the fall of 2019. What was happening up until that time, in those 7 years, when you took on a company that some would have said was a little sleepy at that time, and now seeing these record sales, record revenues, you're $1.5 billion in sales, what was happening in that ramp up? Can you share with us kind of a little bit under the covers what we would have seen?
Sure. It was a private equity backed company. It had just been acquired. It was a business that I had actually was interested in acquiring myself with another private equity firm that we couldn't get the deal done, but I loved the business. It was called Garden Ridge, based in Houston, Texas at the time, a little over $300 million in revenue. And so I was had the blessed opportunity to become the CEO. They invited me to come in to deliver a growth plan, create the plan, deliver it, build an executive team, scale the company, take it nationally, and take it public as a liquidity event. And that was the objectives of the private equity firm. And those were my objectives as well. And so we did that. I would say what we focused on is making sure you had the right product value assortment right from the beginning. And we had to make some assortment corrections. We also had a brand that didn't resonate well with customers. The company had a history where, in fact, it had been bankrupt and had not been a great place to work. And so when I did the research, it was clear that while it was a great business, it wasn't going to scale with that background and that history. So we had to actually leave that history behind, at least the name, go to a new name, get a fresh start. In the world of e-commerce, you have all that history. Yelp reviews for customer experiences that weren't great. You have Glassdoor that tells you your employee experience wasn't great. You have internet that says the company had been bankrupt. You have to shed all that. So we had that. So we had the strategic requirement to change the name of the company. I also moved the headquarters to Dallas because that's where top retail talent lived. I didn't live there either, but I moved my family there just so that we could scale the business. We needed a team of people. We didn't need 400 people at a headquarters building to scale this thing. And so we did that. I put a great executive team together. First and foremost, it starts with team and the right people in place. They hire great people. We moved the headquarters. We revised the business and the product assortment to make sure it was, what essentially it is democratized home decor. It's low price home decor in all styles. So it's a one-stop shop. It's a big box concept, the size of a Walmart or a Target, those kind of big 100,000 square foot stores, but it's only home decor. And it's only our product, private label, private branded, which allows us to sell it at prices below everybody else's sales price. And that's what we did. We made those adjustments. We then changed the name. We then went loud and proud about it from a marketing standpoint. Same store sales started taking off. We had 5 straight years of same store sales growth. We were growing units, opening up units, stores, 20% unit growth for 5 straight years as well. Took the company from $350 million to over $1.4 billion last year in just 6.5-7 years. Highly profitable. So it's been a really great opportunity to do something that I never thought was possible before, to really create a national brand. We took a public 4 years ago on the New York Stock Exchange, which was a really unique opportunity for our team to experience that. And what it allowed us to do most importantly was give everybody in the company an opportunity to be an owner in the company. I wanted everybody to have the same blessing of ownership that I enjoyed and our private equity owners enjoyed. And going public allows you to share the shares with everybody. And we did that. And that's now the situation we find ourselves in, where we have essentially every store manager is an owner in the company. They get shares of stock every year, and our employees get shares as well. And then we all win together, which is the most important thing.
Fascinating story. So there are today, I think last count, 219 or so stores around the country in 40 states.
Yes.
So you went from primarily a local business and now to what you just described. And you're doing it in a time when it seems like a lot of people are told or taught that retail is becoming passé. Mm-hmm. Retail is, it's basically your grandfather's or your grandmother's model. Mm-hmm. So obviously that's not true. Mm-hmm. You're proving that it's not true. So if you're standing in front of a college business class, mm-hmm. what are you telling them? What are you teaching them about the power of retail? And how can one be successful in it, especially in a pandemic when so many retail stores, smaller ones, mind you, but nevertheless, so many of them seem to be going out of business, but you did the opposite and it seems like you're doing the opposite. So what are we missing?
Well, it's a personal connection with the consumer is what you need. And I would tell you a face-to-face in-person connection allows for that to be even more intimate and personal. And so having physical presence so that customers can see, touch, and feel, certainly in our category where we're talking about decor, items around primary furniture pieces, think about rugs and lamps and wall art and tabletop decor, patio furniture. You wanna see it, you wanna make sure it matches the paint chip that you have or the throw pillow that you want everything to go after. So see, touch, and feel it. But you have to realize also that everybody pre-shops on the internet. So they decide where they're gonna shop. Do they want to buy online? Okay, yes, you could do that. And what we've done is we've become a full omni-channel retailer this year. It allows people to pre-shop online. They could buy it. They could have it picked up in the store. You could have it delivered to your home. You could have curbside pickup. But also, by having physical stores, when you don't end up with what you wanted or you brought two because you wanted to see which color worked best at home, you want to return it? Well, having a physical store is so much easier than packing it up and resending it back and having all the returns and having that relationship back with the store again and again and again. And what we did differently than most people do too is all of our e-commerce and all of our business is centered after the store. So all that we have one place of inventory. Every store is a warehouse. That's where we fulfill all of our sales out of. And so that team owns that relationship in the community regardless of how it's sold. If it's buy online, picked up in the store, curbside pickup, delivered, returned, it's back to that store and that store director who runs the business. And we feel like the power of bricks and clicks is the way to go forward. But what we also did is we were late adopters to that, but we made sure we rolled out e-commerce profitably. Every single one of our e-commerce transactions makes money. And I know there's a lot of e-commerce businesses out there that are hot and cool, but they don't make money. And I've learned over time in my 30 plus years in businesses, if you don't make money and throw off free cash flow, you're not sustainable over time. And consumers want sustainable companies, and sustainability is delivered by profitability. And so we do both. But at the same time, offering lower prices than even the e-commerce guys do, and enabled by a low cost structure and some other things we've done. But that's how we've done it. We feel like physical stores enable that to have that intimate relationship. And that's why we're continuing to open more and more stores in the future.
Do you see any vulnerabilities in retail in the future? Or have you already identified those and are you taking mitigating steps to counter those?
Well, it's interesting in retail right now. There's in the consumer business, those that are at the luxury side and those are the value side do very well. But if you're stuck in the middle, your customer value proposition is not going to last, and it's going to be challenged. It's going to be challenged by the people below who can take those styles, democratize them at lower prices, and make it easier for people to buy at lower prices. And so what you have to do is either define yourself above and have this great luxury brand with beautiful quality and beautiful stores, but the prices are high, but it's a smaller group of people that can access that. Or you have to be able to have a broad reach with lower prices and great value on the other end. And so what we've done is we've gone there. We've said, hey, we're going to democratize home decor. And so we have the largest assortment at the lowest prices, and we allow that to be seen by our customers and our competitors online. And I would say the people that do that are going to win. The people that are stuck in the middle and don't have a great customer value proposition, I mean, in the end, they will struggle. And, you know, I've been responsible for brands along that way. I was chairman of a fur coat company. And I've been, which is based in New York and sold all across the world. And we sold it to oligarchs and monarchs were our best customers. And then you've got the value business like Old Navy, where I was chief financial officer and head of store operations as well, to now at home, those value players are the ones that are sustaining their business, because in the end, people are very careful with their money. And through economic cycles, you need to be able to be accessible in terms of price points.
Now, you've talked a lot about value, and that message is coming through very clearly. Talk a little bit for us about the quality of the product, because as you mentioned, you have 50,000 SKUs, 50,000 products. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're growing that. How do you identify those channels, those manufacturers? You mentioned that they are branded at home. I'd like you to, if you would, describe that a little bit more for us and the decision-making that goes into what actually ends up in your stores.
Sure. I use the word value because that's what customers are looking for, is the best value. It may not be the lowest price, because sometimes the lowest price has poor quality, and then that comes off cheap, and you want to be great value. And so that's been our journey. I would tell you that is a journey as a value player, as a low price leader. So we are the lowest price. We're going to be the lowest price you'll find out there, below other people's sales price. And so, but it can't be cheap. So we've spent our time focusing on making sure that we have the lowest price, but continue to reinvest our profitability into better quality. So we look for better and better factories. We look for better and better design partners that can help us design products affordably with great value. And because we're at home, the at home brand, we don't pay the brand premium of another person who designed it. So we take the middleman out, which allows us to have that lower price. So it's a journey. It's a continuous effort on our part to improve the quality. Customers' expectations for quality always go up. It doesn't go down. And they expect prices to always go down. And when you always have your price compression as a challenge and the expectation of quality, that's why I would say it's a journey. You have to keep working on it item by item, and you continue to refresh your items to make sure that you can get to that right balance and still deliver what the customer is looking for.
Lee, if the pandemic had not occurred, mm-hmm. and people hadn't moved to an at-home, if you'll pardon the pun, environment where we're doing more work from our homes, we're starting to get used to it. Many people are now preferring it. Some companies are mandating it for the rest of this year, sometimes well into 2021. In fact, some companies are even saying now it's permanent, that they're not going to require their people to come into an office space. So if that had not happened, would we have seen these types of improvements, this rapid growth at home? Probably not to the extent we saw it, but it sounds like you were prepared for this. It sounds like this shift, as I said earlier, that you had a lot of time, a lot of effort, years had gone into this. What does the rest of the year look like for your business? And what are you anticipating for 2021?
Well, we did prepare. I mean, last year was the first year we had negative same-store sales in 6 years. We had 20 straight quarters of same-store sales growth, plus 20% increase in unit growth, and strong profitability every year. And then last year was a step-back year. Still very profitable, but sales from a same-store sales basis weren't positive and slightly negative. And so we went back as an executive team, retooled our business, as I mentioned. We had issues like weather, which affects your spring business, like patio and garden. We had lots of wet weather last spring, which hurt our spring business. We had tariffs due to the trade war we're having with China, U.S. trade war. Our product costs were increasing 25 to 30% increases in cost in certain categories like furniture and accent furniture and wall art. So then we eventually had to raise prices, which meant our customers weren't getting what they expected from a price-value relationship. So then sales were challenged there. Even though our prices were lower than our competitors, they still were above, you know, artificial price barriers. So we had to go back and look at that. And then honestly, our fourth quarter, our Christmas assortment, it was a shortened Christmas season, selling season. The time between Thanksgiving and Christmas was the shortest time in a number of years. And so that, you know, squeezes our selling period for Christmas decor and Christmas trees, and we sell a large assortment of that. And our assortment was good, but then all of a sudden everybody went on sale so much earlier, and we then had to go on sale earlier, and so it was a tough quarter. So all of those events turned into a not perfect year for us, and so we retooled. And so we worked on the things we needed to get back our mojo and start winning again. We did that. We started seeing progress in February. We started seeing, we changed our go-to-market approach. We're everyday low price, but we went to a campaign approach where we highlight a particular category for 3 weeks, show that category pricing, and have that as a campaign, call it EDLP Plus. Those campaigns are starting to drive same-store sales growth for us again, first time in 5 quarters. And then COVID hit. But I would tell you, we started getting momentum before COVID. And what you would have seen now, if that had just continued, you'd still see same-store sales growth in Q1. You would have seen it in Q2. Now, would it have been to these extremes? Well, stores were closed for a long time. There was pent-up demand. There was a stimulus check, too, that happened for our economy and for people that were struggling. And so that brought people back faster. But what it now has done is allowed people to spend more time at home, focus on this category. We think it's going to be a multi-year benefit to our category. Just like when 9/11 happened, people didn't travel as much. They stayed at home. They felt less comfortable traveling for obvious reasons. And that was a multi-year benefit for this category. We'll see the same thing here. There's no vaccine in sight, unfortunately. So people are going to be careful for some time, which means they'll be home for some time. So I can't say that I'm working any harder than any other people in retail because they're all working super hard. It's just some categories are more important to our consumer than others. And thankfully, we're one of those categories right now.
Your executive team and you are doing a phenomenal job. Your hard work is paying off. That shows in the numbers. There's another side of your business, though, that's very interesting to me. And I think those who are watching and listening will also find this to be a fascinating study. When you took over in 2012, late 2012, you were charged with moving the company to become public. Mm-hmm. And so that required the formation of a board and all of the necessary hoops to jump through to become a public business. Mm-hmm. By the way, I also had the experience, not to the extent you're going to explain to us, I hope, but I had an experience of working with a company in going public. This is a few years ago. Actually, it was about the same time that you were working through this at home. Eventually, despite our efforts, we decided against it in the end. So we pulled out.
Okay.
We just couldn't get the valuation that we were hoping for. But you've been successful getting the valuation, obviously. But the board is what I find very interesting. If anyone looks, they'll see on the at-home board a very diverse collection of professionals, people with vast experience, people who've served as presidents, CEOs, chief revenue officers, and so forth for Norwegian Cruise Lines, Caribou Coffee, Lowe's, PetSmart, the list goes on. How did you go about forming that board? Because if I understand correctly, Lee, you actually started from a blank piece of paper, and which is a rare opportunity that a CEO has. So walk us through that experience.
Yeah, when I joined, there was the private equity owners, and they had appointed one person to the board, and so we had to fill the whole board. And what I did is I sat down with our private equity owners, and we mapped out a plan. I said, if you look at some of the greatest companies out there, and there was a study that I had read, a book called Blueprint to a Billion by David Thompson, an ex-McKinsey partner, who had studied all the companies that had gone public over the course of the past 35 years in the U.S. or more. And he only found less than 400 companies that had gone from going public and made it to $1 billion. And he found, and they were all industries, and he found 7 common characteristics to those companies that had made it to $1 billion. So this essentially a blueprint to $1 billion is was his premise. One of them was a high powered board. And so I knew that in the back of my mind, and I knew we had to have that. And so when we looked at what our board needed to be, we knew we were a high growth retailer and we wanted to be a high growth retailer. And the only way you achieve that is you have people around you who help you get there, who've actually been there and done that. So we wanted folks that had been at high performing retailers that had scaled it and that had scaled their business from smaller to larger. So take, for example, Larry Stone, who's our lead director. He started Lowe's as a store employee. I think there was only maybe 5 stores there and became eventually the president and chief merchandising officer and chief operating officer for Lowe's, for a number of years. And he sits on the Dick's board as well, Dick's Sporting Goods board. And so there's an example of somebody who had scaled it. Phil Francis, another person who was chairman and CEO of PetSmart, he started when they had less than, I think, 200 stores. And when he retired as chairman and CEO, and it was the CEO the whole time during this time, went from 200 to 1,200 stores. So he knew what scale meant and what it took to build infrastructure to grow. We needed to go public. And so we needed to have somebody who ran the audit committee. Wendy Beck is who we selected. And she had taken Norwegian Cruise Lines public as the CFO, had been the CFO of Domino's Pizza before that as a public company, just after their IPO. We needed somebody who had been through that IPO process. So I give you an example. Those three were our first three board members that we hired. And we looked for people just like that at that caliber. For example, John Butcher, our most recent board member who came from us to us from Caribou Coffee, where he's the CEO. He also runs the bagel businesses that that private equity company owns, which is Noah's and Einstein and Bagels. Yeah. So he has those businesses under his watch as well. But before that, he was a senior merchant at Target. And so he had been at big box retail, had been involved in our category, and had been a very big leader at a, you know, a great retailer like that. And then now was the CEO of a really great brand. Somebody had a cult following. And we think about our brand, we want to be a cult-like brand. And so that's an example of another skill set. We wanted a merchant, but who'd been at a cult-like brand. We wanted somebody who'd been in marketing, for example, who'd been in multiple brands. Elizabeth Charles had been the chief marketing officer at Athleta and Petco and Victoria's Secret and brands like that. And so examples like that, Paula Bennett, who's also on our board, who'd been the CEO of J. Jill for over a decade and took it from a small brand to just a great brand that we all know. And so I give you those examples. Joanne, who's also on our board, she's the acting CEO of Tapestry, who's the owner of Coach and Kate Spade. She was the CFO there. So skill sets like that, a high-powered group of people. It's a diverse board. We have four women on our board. Our customers are women, so we should have our board reflect the face of our customer. But we need them to be high performing because we want high performing and they're my boss. And I need a boss who's gonna push me to push our business to reach its full potential. And thankfully, folks like that were interested and willing to be a part of the At Home family.
Now, hang on a second. You said fortunately they were willing, but as you know, at Game Face Execs, we like to talk about how the power of persuasion and influence plays a part in everything we do in business and in our personal lives. Yep. So Lee, don't undersell yourself here. You had to be a persuasive individual.
Oh
yeah. So
I courted each of them individually. I mean, Joanne, who was at the time the chief operating officer, Abercrombie and Fitch, was a busy person, had a busy job. And so I said, I'll fly to Columbus. I'll go to your office. I'll meet with you. Please just give me the opportunity to talk about At Home and the At Home board. And she did that. Paula Bennett, she was at an investor conference two years before she joined our board. And I said, could you just meet with me? And she gave me 15 minutes in a hallway. And so, yeah, I'm courting them because we're a small time and they were big time. But I wanted them to know what's possible and the fun part about building a great company. And if they had that entrepreneurial spirit at all, which they all do, to help build something great, I said, hey, why don't you build the next great American retail company with me? And I was grateful they said yes. And I'm grateful that they're my boss and my partner and we're better for it.
So, I won't ask you who, but I'm sure others said no to you. Not everyone's going to say yes. I mean, that would be a phenomenal close rate, as we say. but you were successful in getting the attention of some very, as you say, high power individuals with terrific experience who already had done what you wanted to do for the most part at Home. Yep. At the same time, you also seem to have the confidence to be able to hire people who might know, please receive this in the with the respect it's intended, mm-hmm. might know a little bit more than you in some areas.
Sure. Yeah. That's how it should be.
Well, you know, you
hire people smarter than you and you'll get smarter.
Well, is that easy to say after the fact? I mean, because, you know, it's worked out for you. You've been successful. But I fear that too many people, let's talk about young entrepreneurs, let's talk about startups mm-hmm. who are looking to take this great idea that they hatched in their basement or their garage, and they think that, no, I don't want to involve other people who might take advantage of me, who are smarter than me and might, you know, they might snooker me out of too much share of my business. But you don't have that attitude. You've been in private equity. You know how it works. What are some lessons those young entrepreneurs and startups ought to be learning from your example?
Well, you want to have the best team out there. I mean, I grew up in New England, and they always had this philosophy to buy, you know, draft the best available athlete. And so you want the best one, even if that position was already filled. You deal with that problem. You want the best available athlete. And so I just believe just get the best people you can around you, and it'll make you better. And you'll learn a lot from those folks, and they'll push you to be better. And I'm not uncomfortable with that. I'm comfortable enough in myself to say, yeah, I'm not going to be so smart in certain areas. In other areas, I may be stronger, but either way, shore up the whole team. There's a book out there about, it's called A Team of Rivals, which is about Abraham Lincoln when he became president. He picked for his cabinet three of the people that ran against him as president. And some of them were in different parties. And then he actually formed this cabinet of people that had more success winning elections, more success in politics, more international experience than he did. But now he's considered one of the greatest presidents we ever had, certainly one of the most courageous people we have in our history in this country. And so courage is required to have a willingness to hire people smarter than yourself. But I would tell you, you're better for it. And it makes you a little uncomfortable sometimes because they are smarter than you. And aren't you supposed to be their boss? But guess what? The whole enterprise wins, and you win because you learn. And when you stop learning, life is over. And so I love being around people that I can learn from. And I would tell you, I'm so impressed with my team individually to a person. I would take our team against any other retail company in the world, regardless of the size, and say, I've got the best in those slots, and I learn from them every day.
I would just like to echo what you're saying. Something I haven't shared with my own clients at Gameface, but that is a fact and a reality, is that back in the early 2000s, I was starting to see some growth that was getting away from me. Our business was, as you've seen before in other businesses, you can grow too fast, right? You can scale too quickly. Yeah. Everyone wants to scale, but then sometimes it just gets away from you. And that was happening to me in the early 2000s. Mm. And I met two people who were smarter than me, who showed an interest in my business. Mm. And at first I was not only intimidated by them, but I didn't trust them. Because I thought, well, they have some underhanded motive, and eventually they're gonna, you know, fool me into taking my business. Mm-hmm. But you talk about courage. The other word that I would throw out there, and this is something that one of our previous guests, Stephen M. R. Covey, is an expert in talking about, and that's trust. I had to develop a sense of trust in those people, not dumb trust. You gotta be wise. You gotta do your due diligence and do your research on people. But when I finally began to trust those two individuals, they did fantastic things for my business and helped me see my blind spots. Mm-hmm. And so you've learned that lesson, obviously, previously in your career. If I may also, let's go to the other side of your business. We've talked about the senior leadership and the board. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned earlier the managers of your 200 plus stores and the people that work with them. What do you learn from them, Lee? How are they different than other retail workers that I might encounter when I walk into some of your competitors' places?
Well, I always say the most important job in our company is actually the store director position. They, each and every one of them, run a very big enterprise. Each business does about $7 million in sales. They only do it with 30 people. It's in the store the size of a Costco or a Walmart, so 100,000 square feet. On average, they may walk 7 or 8 miles a day in their shift because the store is so big to get across it and so on. They're moving freight. Their team's moving freight from the back room to the front of the store. It's a self-help model. And they actually run a playbook from us that says, here's how we want the store to be merchandised. Here's the product we want to have highlighted in these certain in parts of the store. Here's the policies and procedures that we have for you to run effectively, knowing that we're trying to help them run it the most efficient way possible. But what we found is our team members, they're incredibly devoted and hardworking. I mean, it is a hard, very physical job because you're moving a lot of product and you're an owner operator. I mean, we give them shares of stock, so they do own part of the company, but they're operating it every day. And they're the ones seeing our customers every day. I don't see a customer. I don't serve a customer. You know, I'm overhead. I'm store support. They're the ones who see the customer every day. They're the ones who hear every day what the customer was looking for, what they were expecting in the store. They're the ones who have to deliver that customer experience. And is the store neat, clean, and organized always? Are they getting the support that they need from our employees? And then can you fill out the roster every day to have enough people to show up? And this is an hourly workforce who most of them have just a high school degree. And I say just meaning, they don't have as many opportunities. And so they're going to go to where maybe they can get $1 an hour more. And so how do you convince people to stay with you when they could get paid more somewhere else and they could do an easier job? And so I'm just so grateful for our store directors. They are just wonderful people. They're very loyal. The commitment level to our company is extraordinary that they exhibit every day. And so my job is to serve them. How can I help them and make it easier for them?
Your store directors have to be persuasive as well in order to get those associates to agree to that job at whatever wage or you may be offering. Can you share with us a little bit more about the characteristics of an effective store director when it comes to the skill of persuasion, the skill of selling? Is that something that you require when you hire them, that they have to have a sales background or at least a proclivity to it?
Actually, our stores are self-help. So it's a self-help labor model. So think about Costco is a store that people are most familiar with. We're like that. We're a warehouse store. We put it on the shelf. There's no commission sales force. It's really self-help shopping enabled. The customer goes around without getting a lot of help. If they need something off the shelf and brought up to the register or taken out to the car, we'll help them there. But what we do is we just make sure the store is neat, clean, and organized. And then we run the register. And I say, that's it. But there's a lot to that. You still have trailer loads worth of product coming in 3-4 times a week. And then you still have all these customers, what I call pesky customers sometimes that aren't always happy. And you have to put a great face on every day and support them. So we have two teams in our store. We have a customer service team and we have an ops team. And we hire people to those teams. And it's really around personality types. If you're a type of personality who really gets a lot of energy by hanging out with people and helping people, then you're going to be on the customer service team. You'll be in charge of servicing and conditioning an area. And you'll be in charge of running the register and engage with customers. If you like just getting stuff done and making stuff move, well, then guess what? You're going to be on the ops team. You'll be unloading the truck, getting the product to the floor, unloading it, packing it, and getting it all set. Two separate teams, two separate managers underneath the store director that run those teams. And so the store director looks for what do you like out of life? What type of work do you like to do? And we put people on teams that way. And they're the ones that help pick people that are just go-getters and have that entrepreneurial spirit. And then what we do is we make sure that people are rewarded. Everybody in our company is eligible for a bonus. And it's based on their store team performance or our company performance. And those metrics are very known. And at the store level, the store director level, for example, that bonus is uncapped because we want them to feel like an owner-operator. So if you have a 5% increase as your sales plan, and you have a $20,000 bonus, for example. If you did a 10% increase, then that's double. So your bonus is doubled. If you did a 15% increase, you get a triple. And that bonus is uncapped. And so we've had people who've made over $100,000 in their bonus, and they make $75,000, $80,000 for a store director. And their bonus is that much larger because guess what? They had an amazing year. And guess what? Our company had an amazing year because of them. And they own stock. We give them stock every year. They earn stock every year. But then they get this bonus. And we show every store employee in the back of the store. There's a chart that Larry Stone, our lead director, who instituted this at Lowe's. It says, here's how much a store associate makes part-time. per hour and for the year. And here's your bonus. So let's say you make 20, you know, 10 bucks an hour, 20,000, 2,000 hours a year is 20,000 a year. You get a $1,000 bonus. That's what our team member is eligible. But your assistant manager, she makes 40,000 and she gets a $10,000 bonus. The store director mentioned I made 70,000, $20,000 bonus. But your district manager, the person that shows up once a week or so, well, they make $110,000 and their bonus is 30,000 or something. And so we have that chart in the back of the store that says you as an hourly person could someday make $100,000 a year if you want to with our company. And almost all of our store director positions have been filled internally. Almost all of our district manager positions have been filled internally. All of our regional manager positions have been filled internally because we can show people who maybe only have a high school degree, I say only because they just weren't given those opportunities or those weren't accessible to them. They can provide beautifully for their family. And so I, as you can tell, I have a lot of passion for our team. They do amazing work and I want them to win. I want them to take care of their families and realize all the dreams they ever had for because of what they do for our company.
I think we're hearing really a culmination of a very rich career that you've had, Lee. All of that experience that you've had over the years at different brands and different roles really is culminating in what you're describing right now. It's a wonderful story. I want to go back, though, in time a little bit.
Okay.
Talk about your career. I appreciate everything you shared with us about At Home. So, for example, you've had three prominent roles, more than that actually, but three in the retail business. You were the president of Nike Affiliates. You were, as you said earlier, the chief operating officer of Gap. You were the chief financial officer of Old Navy. Any one of those positions is like, man, that's nirvana for a lot of people. They're going to retire with that position. Why would they want to do anything else? Such great brands with such customer affinity. As you have looked back through the years at those types of opportunities, did you move on because of fit? Did you move on because you had achieved the goals that you had set for yourself? Did you move on because there was a better opportunity for you? Was it all of that? Was it none of that? Help us understand kind of that career path that has taken you to all these different and diverse experiences.
Well, I've just been so blessed. It's been a great career. I've had the opportunity, as you mentioned, to work with some great brands, some amazing people. A lot of the times at those places, I was able to know the founder of that great brand. And so that was really neat to be able to see what they had visioned to be a part of helping that be realized. And each career decision has its own set of decision-making criteria. First and foremost, it still comes down to what's best for my family. And I would tell you I've been married to my wife, Linda, for almost 34 years. She's just been the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life. And she's just a wonderful partner and my greatest business consultant in my life, and advisor in every decision, just obviously like you, Rob. And what's right for our family and our children. And so sometimes it was, stay where you are because one or two of my kids wanted to finish a high school in that town. And so we made a decision to do that, or now is a good time for them to move because it's a good chapter in their life. And so we could move. So each career decision still involved a family decision that came down to a family council where they would vote and everybody got the same vote. But hopefully my persuasion would help them want to go where I thought the career was going to be benefiting. I also had to provide for a large family. Eight children, they get expensive, especially when they're in college. And so an upwardly mobile career allows us to be able to provide better for our families. And I like learning. So part of my moves was because I had learned all I could and I couldn't learn anymore where I was. And so I wanted to learn more. And so then I needed to go somewhere else to learn more, maybe learn a different industry. I mean, when I went from the Gap brand of families, so from Gap and Old Navy, which was apparel, which was new to me before then. So that was an amazing experience. And I worked with great people and great brands to then go to Nike. I mean, gosh. And I got to be the president of the Nike affiliate. So all those group of businesses, I was in charge of Cole Haan and Converse and Hurley and Bauer Hockey and Starter. And it was a fantastic opportunity. And then to be on the Nike executive team to learn what Nike brand did to be what they are today. I mean, it was just such an opportunity to learn and soak it in like a sponge, as they say. So part of it is the learning, because I just can't stand still and stop learning. Part of it is to not stop in my own development. You know, some places said, hey, we can't ever see you as a president. We can see you as a chief operating officer, but you're not a merchant. And so then you can't be a president with us. Well, I thought I could be. And if that company didn't see that because they decided to put some artificial barriers on my potential, and I thought I had more potential, and I didn't listen to the voices where people said, oh, you're only a finance guy, you can never be those things. And I thought, no, I can be those things, and I'm going to go after that. And so I had to move on to go after what was I thought was my full potential. And I think we're supposed to realize our full potential in this life. And so my career has been blessed, and I've learned so much, and I've worked with great people, and I've been taught by great mentors that have helped me have those experiences, and people put a bet, you know, took a bet on me, and I appreciate that too.
I have to tell you a story that you just reminded me of that I have forgotten. It's not about you, but it is about one of the brands that you've worked for. So it's not a secret story, but it's one that I haven't thought of for a long time. It regards Nike. When GameFace was based in the Portland area, I would pay a lot of visits to Nike.
Yep.
You were there at the time, leading those various brands you just shared with us. And of course you were in the inner circle. I think you were one of the top eight executives at Nike, meeting with Phil Knight and Charlie Dennis and other people that were running the company at the time. I had a chance to get to know Phil Knight in a different way. And one time it was Phil and I and one other individual. We were chatting at Nike in near Phil's office. And the other individual just kind of threw out some crazy notion that maybe there was a position for me at Nike. And at the time, I'm running my own business, GameFace. This guy was just conjecturing, maybe Rob could serve in this way or in this way. And Phil just looked at me and he pulled his sunglasses down. And as only you know, pulled his sunglasses down, looks at me and says, "You're not the Nike type." So the conversation stopped there. And so it's interesting. We were friends. I think there was some, I certainly respect Phil Knight for everything he's done for Nike, for the sports industry, for commerce. I hope there's a little bit of mutual respect for me, but even though you're friends, even that doesn't necessarily make you the right fit for a company or for a brand.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've had a lot of people who've come to you because you've been in private equity as well, where you get to identify people that should serve within a particular enterprise or company that would be good fit for management. And I'm sure people have come to you and they said, "Lee, how about me? Can't I be a candidate?" Mm-hmm. And you probably have had to say, you know, you're just not a right fit. So what does that mean in your mind? Is it okay to say to someone, it's just not a good fit? Is that a diss? Or is that perhaps a message that there's something better for them?
It's not a diss, it's just a reality. And it's a reality in both parts. You could decide this company isn't a good fit for me, for the culture. And when I've always interviewed people for a role, I've always said, hey, we're both figuring this out. You know, so my first interview with a candidate, whether it's for the board or a member of the executive team, I go spend 2 hours with them. And we just get to know each other first and foremost. Because I want to see, do I like this person? Do I want to spend all this time with them? And you know, I have this policy at our company. We have a no jerk ratio policy. So we just don't hire jerks. a jerk just means somebody you just can't work with. Okay. And it just means because I have a certain style. And, you know, I would tell you, I'm not a screamer or a swearer. And so I'm not going to want that around our business. I think it doesn't really help bring the best out of people. But either way, some people do that. And that's up to them, but that may not work for us. But I would tell you, you just got to figure out the culture of the place. And whether you're looking for the role or you're creating that culture, you want to make sure you sustain that from the culture standpoint in your own company, or that you fit that as a candidate. And it's not a ding, it's just a reality. Culture is just as much a part of the business as the performance is. And the culture delivers the performance. And I would tell you, I mean, gosh, you know, at Nike, for example, that culture is so strong. It's about winning. It's about being on the offense always, as one of their maxims says. Man, if you're not competitive and you're not willing to just go at it and try to help the brand and the business be so successful, you're just going to be left behind. And that's just who they are. And that's not bad. That's not good. It just is. And guess what? They're extraordinary, you know? And so that they had a strong culture. Gap had a very strong culture. You know, I mean, when I started at Gap, I mean, I would walk into a room and people would just look me down and up because was I fashionable enough to be there? You know, and I had just come from technology and I was, you know, I'm wearing not so cool clothes and suddenly
I want everyone to know you are very fashionable.
Well, right now. I'm better than I was back when I started at Old Navy, but you know, I would tell you, I learned I had to make sure I had fashion denim on and a really great jacket or blazer and my belt had to match my shoes and my watch band and all these things. But that's just part of the culture because they're a fashion business. And so you have to get culture and it has to be right for you. And you have to make sure they're right for your company. And that's not bad. It just is. And don't ever give up on that. And don't settle for that either, because it'll come back to burn you later anyway. Hmm.
You are a great advisor. You've given us great advice here today in this episode. I also know that you're an advisor for organizations outside of At Home. Just as you've gathered a board of directors, you serve on the board of directors. Particularly, I'd like to talk about on other boards of directors, I should say. But okay. I'd like to focus a little bit on the industry of sport, because you serve on the board of Larry H. Miller Group, which is the owner of the Utah Jazz. You serve on the owner's advisory group for, in fact, I thought I would share this with you, Lee, today, for this franchise.
Ooh, the Dallas Stars. Go yeah. Stars.
Yeah. This is a hockey team, for those of you watching who can't see, who are looking at this jersey. Mm-hmm. This is an NHL hockey team in Dallas. In fact, I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, name. Eddie.
There you go. So this is a pretty cool jersey the Stars gave me a few years ago when I was working for them. But you serve on Tom's ownership advisory group, the owner of the club. And then you also have ownership interest in a AA franchise in a town where you spent some of your formative years.
Yep.
So I'd like you, if you would, just to share with our audience a little bit about those collective experiences serving as an advisor in the sports industry. I think what you do with the Dallas Stars, which is where you live and work right now in that community, that's particularly of interest to me. And I think it would be to our audience as well.
Yeah, I'm grateful to be a part of that team. I would tell you what Tom and Jim Leitz set up, Tom the owner, Jim the CEO at the time, and now Brad, who's the CEO. But they envisioned early on when Tom bought the team that since Tom lived out of town, the idea was they obviously wanted the enterprise to be commercially successful, not just have a great team and win a lot of great games and hopefully win a Stanley Cup, but also make it commercially successful because Tom's a very successful business person. And since he wasn't in town, he wasn't going to be there to help nurture those business relationships that are necessary for the team to be commercially successful. You need sponsorship. You need people who are going to be supporting the arena and filling the seats. You need to have community involvement to have the entire community want to be a part of the Stars movement as well. And so they formed this ownership advisory group that I joined right after I moved to Dallas. And I was grateful for it. And our job at the ownership advisory group is to help them have the business of the Dallas Stars, the business side, be commercially successful, help it make money, and help them think through how do you get more sponsors involved in the Dallas Stars? How do you get more people to come to games? What does that take? What network do we have that can help them and introduce them to those people that could then have those people be a part of the Dallas Stars family in the business? And so that's what I do. I help them, I serve them, and I get all the benefits of being an owner. They're kind enough to let us be a part of the, you know, the ownership group in the sense that we get the owner's box and we can travel with the team and so on, tickets to games, access to all sorts of team experiences and so on. So that's great for my family who is new to Dallas. That allows me to connect more with the team. but I can then help the team be commercially successful, which then allows the team to stay in town, because it's important for a town to have a team. And that's why I'm a part of the Montgomery Biscuits ownership group too, because I grew up in Montgomery, first through eighth grade, and I want that town to have a sense of community. And when you have a town like we do, we have a team downtown at the riverfront, at this beautiful stadium that the city built, it just brings the community together. And as you know, it brings families together and creates memories for families. And I think sports creates those family memories that nothing else does. And if you can make it commercially successful, then those teams stay in town and create more memories for families.
Well, you know, you've been able to open up the at-home stores. I'm sure you're using great mitigation efforts to be cautious and abide by certain, you know, guidelines as to how we should respond to the pandemic. We haven't been able to do that in the sports industry yet. For those who are listening and watching who come from that industry, I think you would agree with me when I say that, boy, our communities need that. They need to be have that release to get back into a sporting environment because of all the reasons you just said. And it's not just for entertainment. It's not just for a relaxation, but it's also because it's a great way and place to do business. And I'm sure at Dallas Stars games, you've done business.
Oh yeah.
You've taken people there.
Yep.
So hopefully from this, you know, from your lips, right? We'll be able to get back to sports soon. And by the way, speaking of sports, for those who are watching on YouTube, I just think we owe it to them just to set the record straight here, Lee. Are you any relation to Larry Bird?
No, I'm not. I grew up after eighth grade, went back to Boston. I'm a Boston Celtics fan. In front of me actually is a signed Larry Bird jersey on the wall. And I'm just a fan of him, but no relation whatsoever. If you saw me play basketball, that wouldn't even have been in question.
So the jersey doesn't say to my little bro, Larry?
Nope. I had to buy it on my own.
Well, Lee, this has been a really enlightening conversation. Thanks for letting us come into your store, so to speak, and giving us a tour of what is making At Home so successful. And we wish you and your company and your associates continued success. And I would encourage all of our listeners and viewers to get into your store or get online and see the quality products that you have and the value that you provide. By the way, for those who are interested, where would we find you? What's your ticker on the stock exchange?
HOME, home.
How appropriate. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for letting us join you in your home, Lee, and at home. And once again, have a great rest of 2020 and a terrific 2021.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks so much for this opportunity. Take care.
Thanks for being a part of this episode of Game Face Execs. If you found any of it useful or helpful, please rate or like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. I always appreciate you referring us to others as well. I'll see you next week. Until then, persuade, influence, inspire.